to anatomic position. So here are a couple exam figures. Right? Here is an anterior view. That's the front view. And another name for anterior is ventral. And here are a bunch of places on your body. Like, for instance, your eyes. That's the orbital region. Your ears. That's the otic region. Maybe it's labeled on the other slide. What else is... You got to know all of these things right here. For instance, what's a good one? Patellar region is your kneecap. And there's a bone in there, and it is called the patella, right? So by knowing these things right here, you can learn a lot of anatomy at the same time. So it seems a little dry to memorize these different names, but it's really important, and you're going to use these names for the rest of the class, maybe the rest of your life even. If you say axillary, that means your armpit. You don't want to be walking around talking about armpits, right? You want to say axillary. And, of course, then you'll sound educated, which is fantastic. Oral region is your mouth. Okay, I did want to say something about this ear region right here. There are some instruments that a physician or clinical provider, might use to look inside your eye and a different one to look inside your ear. They sound familiar. Okay, the instrument that they use to look inside your eye, anybody know what that's called? Maybe. Ophthalmoscope. Okay. And it's different than the one they use to look in your ear. And if you know what this region is called, then you know the name of that instrument. It's called an otoscope. Otoscope. Sounds really similar, right? It's easy to mix up. So be particular with the pronunciation of these things. Abdominal region, umbilical, right around your belly button. You don't want to say belly button, right? You want to say umbilicus. Same thing for forearm, your arm, top of your shoulder. All of these are really important anatomical terms to know. And right now it's hard, but by the end of the class, you're just going to know all these things anyway. All right, so then the posterior view. Oh, here's otic right here. Nice. Sometimes it gets dropped from a chapter, but it didn't. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Depending on whether it's superior or inferior, anterior and posterior. We got some different names. And I'm going to go over that pretty soon. There's some nice simple designation that you have to be aware of. Okay, just a little bit. So anyway, I want to reinforce this. There might be a drag and drop exercise in Blackboard with this to help you learn these different terms. But it is also a figure in your exam figures. You have one in the study guide with all these things erased, and you can practice labeling. You could write it on that exam figure, or you could use a post-it, okay, and just put a post-it right here. Maybe label it on the backside and then flip it over. And you could even put a post-it on the figure in your book, right, to cover that up, and then say the name out loud and then open up the post-it, take a look, see how close you got to it. Okay, so different ways of studying. Right, let's see what the next slide is like. Let's go over these for fun. You can't understand what's happening here, okay, because the image is really not that clear. We haven't studied anatomy. But you might see, here's a shoulder, here's a neck, right? So you should be able to tell what kind of plane that is that we're looking at through somebody's body. And did we cover that last time? For some reason I thought we did. Maybe I did it in lab. Body planes down over here. Okay, let's look at body planes because that's pretty nice and wrong arrow. It's pretty nice and simple. I'm getting lost. Where is it? Here. Okay. So when you look at this figure, you notice three planes. Okay, because if you forget about time, our spatial dimensions that we live in has three dimensions to it. Right? You can move forwards, backwards, that's one dimension. You can move right and left, that's another one. And what's another way that you can move? Yeah, up and down. Right? And every other way that you move is some combination of those three. Right? So we need three planes to determine every particular location in somebody's body. Like, for instance, if I want to tell you exactly where this Coke bottle is, I need three numbers. What are those three numbers? How far away this Coke bottle is from a wall? Okay. You have to tell me how far it is off the floor. And then you have to tell me one more thing. How close is it to the front wall or the back wall? Right? So right, left, up, down, forwards, and backwards. Those are the three coordinates. So these are what we call the standard imaging planes. And if we separate somebody's body, okay, say with an MRI unit, not in real life, right smack down the middle, you separate a right part from a left part, that's what we call a sagittal section. And because our bodies are highly symmetrical, our right side is pretty much like our left side. So if we go right smack down the middle, that's a special plane, we call that the mid-sagittal. Mid-sagittal is right smack in the middle. Third plane, if we separate some superior part or top part from a bottom or inferior part, that's a transverse plane. And that transverse plane can move up and down. We could look right through the top of somebody's head, right? Or right through their belly button, through their kneecaps. Same thing for sagittal. Mid-sagittal is here. Anything off of midline is just called a sagittal plane. We might want to look at somebody's shoulder, right? So we'd move the sagittal plane way over to their shoulder. Want to look right smack in the middle of their brain? Move it right here, okay? So we got what? Sagittal. What's this one?
Transverse.
One more. We only need one more, and that is frontal. Frontal is a plane like this. It's going to separate an anterior from a posterior part of your body. A frontal plane could chop just the very tip of your nose off from the rest of your body, or could be right in the middle of the brain. Again, it can go backwards and forwards, but there's no symmetry in that dimension, so there's no mid. There's no mid-frontal. So frontal can run around with another name commonly. It's called coronal. Coronal or frontal are the same. Your book likes to use frontal. I don't think I've ever used any equipment that called it frontal. That has always been called coronal. And usually it's because of trade names. Somebody patented a name, and so another company can't use that name. All right, so these are the planes. So we could check this really, really quickly. Actually, I want this over here. Right, put that down there for a second. Okay, so let's figure out these planes. What's this one? Sagittal. What's this one? Okay, you guys are good. That's how we did it. That's how we did in lecture. So now, what's this one? Okay, on the test, got to do it really fast. All right, so you can move on to the next question. So we got? Yeah, nice. Okay, so you just have to practice like that. Hopefully it will come to you pretty quickly. All right, now what about this person right here? Is she in anatomic position? Yes or no? Yes, because the thumbs are pointing out laterally. Right, these bones right here are nice and parallel to each other. Actually, I want this over here. Okay, what did I do to the computer? Sagittal, transverse, frontal, mid-sagittal. Parasagittal means off to the side. It's still sagittal, but it's off to the side. Oblique, every once in a while, okay, we might want to take an image on a diagonal across somebody's body, and it doesn't fall right on the frontal or sagittal or coronal plane. Okay, we have to angulate it to look at the anatomy more precisely. That's called an oblique section. But an oblique is just a combination of these basic three. Okay, all right. That's it. Yeah. Yeah. You can have any location, anywhere in here. So it could be like an infinite number of locations, as long as it's not mid-sagittal.
But versus sagittal?
Sagittal just could be mid-sagittal or parasagittal. It's just more general.
Okay.
And some people might use... it's more specific. Yeah. So if you're going into imaging, you probably want to use the more specific terminology, right? If it's not important, then you probably don't want to mention it. Directional terms. Well, the front is anterior. And how do you have to think of these things? Where do you have to put your body? Anatomic position. Yeah, anatomic position. Anterior is the front, posterior is the back. Usually we talk about these terms, a structure compared to another one. So usually we talk about two locations in your body and what's the relationship between those two locations. So, how about my heel? Think of my heel, your heel, and your belly button. How would you describe where your belly button is compared to your heel in terms of anterior and posterior? Other ways to do it, but in terms of anterior. So, where's your belly button? Anterior compared to your heel, right? In anatomic position. Superior, inferior. Superior means above, and inferior means below. So, where is your nose compared to your belly button? It is? Superior doesn't mean better, worse, or whatever. It just means on top of, in anatomic position. Cranial and caudal are pretty much the same thing as superior and inferior, but a little bit different. It works better in other animals. Caudal means literally toward your tail. All right, so your tail is down over here someplace, but we don't really have a tail, right? Cranial means up toward your brain. So that sort of means superior. Caudal sort of means inferior. There's some parts of your body that curve around a little bit, certain parts of your brain, and sometimes that terminology is used, cranial and caudal. Medial and lateral. In anatomic position, your thumbs are lateral. Medial is toward midline, so think of some midline, a mid-sagittal section. If something is closer to that line, then it is medial compared to something that is farther away from that midline. So what about my little finger compared to my thumb?
Medial,
that's right. What about my elbow compared to my belly button?
Lateral.
Lateral, yeah. So there's different ways to describe. If I have a question like that on a test, I'll try to pick a couple structures where you only have one answer, right? Not a couple answers, yeah. Oh, okay. Your heel is posterior compared to your umbilicus, right? And your umbilicus is anterior compared to your heel, right? Yeah. Yeah.
Is it the cranial and caudal used for animals because we don't have a tail?
Yeah, it's really good for dogs, horses, cats, that kind of stuff. Yeah. Just imagine we had a tail. Okay. Yeah. I didn't quite hear the word.
What's the caudal?
Caudal. Okay. Your tailbone is what compared to your chin? You could say it's inferior, but it would also be proper to say it is caudal. Okay? Because it's sort of like your tail. Your brain kind of curves around a little bit. Some structures are pretty much at the same level, but one is curved down just a little bit more. We call that caudal, because of the way the brain curves and turns around. You don't really have to appreciate that right now. Superior, inferior, cranial, and caudal, pretty much the same thing. I'll mention some specific examples in a month or two. Okay. Yeah, yeah. These two right here, pretty much the same, like that. Okay. And guess what? Anterior has another name, exactly another name. In humans, anyway, not for other animals. Anterior has another name. It could be called ventral, right? Anterior and ventral in us is exactly the same. Posterior and dorsal are exactly the same. You could fill in your lecture notes right here. I didn't think of it when I made these lecture notes. Okay, ventral and dorsal, front, back, anterior, posterior. Medial, lateral, we did. This might be the most difficult one to understand. Proximal and distal, what does this mean? Okay. Think of some central location in your body, maybe where your heart is. That's a good thing to think about. And you got a bunch of blood vessels coming out of your heart, going to your extremities, like your arms, for instance. Right? And so we want to be able to describe the location of things in your cardiovascular system and how they relate to the heart. And they're all connected together. Right? So there's a blood vessel in your arm, okay, over here, and there's a blood vessel coming off the top of the heart. We call that the aorta. One is proximal and one is distal. The one that's farthest away from some center location is the distal one. The thing that's closest to that center piece is the proximal one. All right, so this artery way out over here, far away from the heart, is the distal artery. The one that's closest is the proximal artery. And they're kind of connected to each other. So when you use proximal and distal, you should think of things that are sort of connected to each other, like nerves over here connected to nerves over here, blood vessels that are here connected to ones over here. Things that don't have connections, it's harder to think of that sometimes. But you could use elbow and shoulder. They're sort of what? They're sort of right in the same area. I wouldn't say which one is more medial or lateral. I wouldn't say which one is more left or right. You could say superior, inferior, right? But you could also say the shoulder is proximal compared to your elbow. Your elbow is distal because it's farther away from that center location in your body, and they are connected to each other. Okay. Proximal, close. And that's why when you take somebody's pulse, what do they call that over here in your wrist? Okay, it's a radial pulse because you're measuring that pulse on your radial artery. Right, that's really nice. But it also goes by another name. More general. Radial is really nice. That's a good term to use, but it has another name. Sometimes it's called a distal pulse because it's what? Far away from the heart. Okay. And just here's another term, sort of opposite from distal. You could take a pulse here. Okay. We don't call that a proximal pulse. Usually we call that central. Right? But distal means far away. But radial pulse is excellent because that's the radial artery. Yeah. Center location. Center location in your body.
So the heart is the center.
Your heart, for most purposes, is right in the center of your body. You know it's a little bit to the left, but for our discussion, we'll just say that's some center location. Okay? Okay, superficial and deep. Superficial means on the surface. Deep means an underlying structure. Like, where is my brain compared to my nose? Is it deep or superficial?
Deep.
Yeah, brain is deep. Right, you got to dig through stuff to get to it. So deep means some layer that's not on the surface. All right. Okay, so that's directional terms. Now these things, I don't know if these are in your book, okay, head, neck, but it's important. And it's easy to confuse some of these things. Okay, like for instance, if I raise this thing up like that, what am I raising? What am I raising up? Okay, and unfortunately you would be wrong if you were to say arm. Okay. This is my upper appendage, here's my lower appendage. What I'm raising right here, we got to make a distinction between this thing between my shoulder and my elbow and this thing between my elbow and my wrist. All right, so between my elbow and my shoulder, that's my arm and nothing else. Shoulder and elbow, arm. Between elbow and wrist, that's not my arm, believe it or not, that is my forearm. And you probably want to be precise when you talk about those things, especially in here. And in a clinical situation, you want to be precise too. All right, same thing for my lower appendage. Right? That's just as unbelievable. Okay, you might think this thing right here, that's my leg. Okay, between my hip and my knee, you might think that's my leg, you might think it's your leg, but it's not. That's your thigh. Okay, hip and knee is thigh. Between my knee and ankle, that's my leg. Okay, so it's a little strange. Easy to make a mistake on that, but not after you hear the definition. Okay, body cavities. Ooh, what could you tell me about body cavities? Something special with body cavities. Special opportunity. What is that special opportunity? Yeah, extra credit, drawing in lab. Okay. So those of you that have been registered for the class and you have a nice email address in Blackboard, you've got all my emails, and this is part of the welcome letter for an extra credit drawing in class on a blank piece of paper, right? And it's a little bit modified compared to this diagram right here, but I do want you to know these cavities. So it just gets you on your way to understanding spatial relationships. It gets you on your way for drawing. If you have trouble remembering something, go ahead and draw it out. Draw it out first time by looking at a book, then put the book away, draw it out on a blank piece of paper, and that will help you remember it. You might have to draw it out a whole bunch of times. Talk to somebody about anatomy. Talk to your grandma about knees. Okay? I don't know what else to talk about. Just pick somebody and talk about anatomy. That will use your whole brain, and you'll have a much easier time remembering things if you verbalize. So study with a good study group and talk about stuff. Talk about anatomy. Yeah. Nope. Just what I gave you in the welcome letter. Just exactly like that. Yeah. This will all be really obvious to you when you're done with the class. Okay. All right, so here we could take some cavities, all right, and a cavity is deep inside your body. It's not superficial. Superficial structures are usually muscles and bones. Okay, we call that just your body, your soma. Right, but we have to have spaces inside our body to put various kinds of organs, visceral organs. Visceral organs go inside cavities. And we can think of a whole bunch of different cavities, but we want to organize them to see how they're connected to each other, which means they probably have some kind of related function as well. We see some cavities that are in the back. We don't want to use that term. We see some cavities in the front. We don't want to use that term. So what are we going to call the cavities in the back? Yeah, and I see two of them. That's the dorsal body cavity. Remember, dorsal is the same thing as posterior. And we have cavities in the front. We're going to call those the ventral body cavities. Difference between ventral and dorsal. we don't usually say anterior body cavities, but you could, right, because anterior and ventral are the same. All right, well, here you have the dorsal cavity. We can have cavities inside cavities. So what makes up the dorsal body cavity is the cranial cavity that contains the brain and the vertebral cavity that contains the spinal cord. These are both dorsal body cavities, and of course they're connected to each other, right? So it's nice that they're both in the dorsal body cavity. And as a matter of fact, this is going to be important because when we study the nervous system, one of the pieces of the nervous system we're going to study is called the central nervous system. And this already shows you what the central nervous system is. A definition for central nervous system is brain and spinal cord. So that's the whole thing right there. Okay. These other cavities, let's take a look at these. Thoracic cavity is superior. That's in your chest. Sometimes we call that the thorax. Abdominal cavity is inferior to it, but it's separated by a nice structure that definitely separates it out all the time. That's the diaphragm. It's a muscle, most important muscle for breathing, for inspiration. So it's easy to tell the thoracic cavity from the abdominal cavity. All right. And then down below the abdominal cavity is this one right here. We call that the pelvic cavity. It's bounded by some your hip bones, and it contains some other visceral organs. But there's nothing that really separates the abdominal from the pelvic cavity. Right? Reproductive organs are always going to be in the pelvic cavity. Right? They're never going to wander up over here. So it's a good. There's a reason why we call this the pelvic cavity and abdominal cavity, even though conceptually. So I mean, they are different, even though there's nothing that separates them. Okay, but sometimes, if you have an infection in this cavity, it goes right to this one because there's really nothing separating it. So sometimes you want to think about these cavities together, and here is a nice trick in anatomy. We can talk about this cavity right here together as the abdominal pelvic cavity. So take this word right here, put an O at the end of it, and then append this word to it. You make up a new word. Right, and as long as it has an O between it, it's a legal word, and people know how to think about it, and they'll know what they're talking, know what you're talking about. So abdominal pelvic, not abdominal, but abdominal pelvic cavity. Okay, so that's these things, these two things together. All right, that cavity also goes by another name. It's called the peritoneal cavity, and I think I have that on one of the next slides coming up. Peritoneal cavity. So a structure in anatomy can have a number of different names. Right, and structures can be inside structures, and you just kind of have to be aware of what some of those different names are. If it's a practicum, you only have to tell me one correct name, because I probably don't even know what all the correct names are. And that shouldn't be too much of a surprise, because I know I have a bunch of different names, okay, and you probably have a bunch of different names too, right? Like you would call me Dr. Gober. Some other people might call me Honey. Right? So I know you all have different names. Or call me other things that I don't even want to say. Okay. So just be aware of that. It's not really confusing too much. All right. So there's thoracic, abdominal pelvic, or peritoneal cavity. These things right here make up the ventral body cavity. And where is that? Ah, ventral body cavity right here. All right. So what kind of view is this? Transverse, sagittal, or frontal coronal? Yeah, it's frontal, right? So we're using a frontal or coronal plane. And here we see that dorsal body cavity that's way in the back, but it's just the way the drawing is made. We can see it. Here is the vertebral cavity. These two things make up the dorsal body cavity. And here we have a nice presentation of the ventral body cavity. And what did we say about cavities? There can be cavities inside cavities, right? Okay. Yes. Visceral means deep inside your body, but even more so, it really means inside of a body cavity that's deep. Okay, so it's an organ, but it's inside a cavity. Okay, a muscle is an organ, but it is not in a cavity, so it's not a visceral organ. Okay, okay, and the control is different. The sensation is different. So sometimes we talk about a certain sensation as to being visceral or somatic, and it's good to think about the different locations, right? So somatic is superficial, like skeleton, muscle. Visceral is deep inside your body. You can feel those things, it's just that you don't have a lot of experience. When you get appendicitis, you can feel your appendix. But it's really a confusing kind of feeling because you're not used to feeling what your appendix feels like, okay? But you know it's there. Okay, so let's get back to ventral body cavity. We said there can be cavities inside cavities. Here is all of this that I'm circling is the thoracic cavity, but it's got subcavities. There's a cavity that the lungs are in, so lungs are a visceral organ. They don't go all the way across, so there's a right and left pleural cavity because the lungs are in a pleural cavity that's a subcavity of the thoracic cavity. Right and left. Pleural means lungs. Get an infection of the space around the lungs, we call that pleurisy. That's where that comes from, if you've heard of that. In the very center, you don't have any lungs, but you have a heart, okay, and then you have a bunch of great vessels coming off the top of the heart right here. So this whole place in the middle has a special name. We call that the mediastinum, right? So this whole area right here. You think that's a really good word to know? Yeah, okay. Maybe somebody's having a baby. Baby's born, baby's blue. Guess what we want to look at right away? Stat. We want to look at this area right here. Somebody's going to yell, we need a scan of the mediastinum right away. We need to look at that person's heart, how the blood vessels connected to it, and try to figure that out immediately. Right? So mediastinum is really important because you all know your heart's real important. Superior, up over here, I've never really heard it called that. We just call it mediastinum, but you might have to use that term. Now, the space that the heart is in, that's really special. Okay, it's part of the mediastinum, but it's also called the pericardial cavity. Pericardial means the cavity that the heart is in. The heart is a visceral organ, and it's got special membranes around it as well. If there's an inflammation of these membranes around the heart, we call that pericarditis, infection of that area. Of course, you can imagine that's really serious when that happens. You don't want an infection anywhere near your heart. All right, so pleural cavity, pericardial cavity, and the superior mediastinum make up the thoracic cavity. All right. Those are separated from cavities that are inferior. They're separated by what structure? Very nicely. Nice and clean. Diaphragm, which we see right here. So diaphragm, please see that's not a cavity. It's a structure. And then down below it, we have what? The abdominopelvic cavity, which is made up of the abdominal cavity and the pelvic cavity. You can see their extents now a little bit more clearly. And remember, if you add these two together, abdominal pelvic cavity, it's also called the peritoneal cavity or peritoneum. And I don't see it on this slide. I think it's on the slide someplace. I just don't see it. Maybe it's on the next slide. No, it's not. Okay, so that's it for chapter one. We got some other information that I'd like to cover in another part of the class. Okay, but that's good for chapter one for right now. So let's look at chapter two. It's probably here. Put these things away. Okay, so cytology is just the study of cells. Cyto means cell, ology is the study of. And, of course, we can't see these with our naked eye. So this is a part of microscopic anatomy. We would need a microscope to see these things. And the basic structure that we're going to be looking at through the microscope is called a cell. And here is a cell right here. And it's got a number of components to it, but I want you to, so it looks pretty complicated. So if you have something complicated, what should you do to understand what's going on there? Break it down into smaller parts. And fortunately, I see a lot of nice small parts here. We're going to look at the small parts. And then to understand a cell, we'll just add those parts together and see why it works. All right, well, this thing does work, and it produces something special. Right? This is the basic building block of something special. It produces something special. I'm asking it kind of a weird way. What is it producing? It's producing life. Okay, so if something is alive, it has to be made out of these things, right? And I'll tell you what this thing is. It has a cell membrane that separates the inside living world from the outside dead world. It's got to have cytoplasm, which I see right here. That's a living world with organelles. So here's an organelle called a mitochondria. And there's cytosol, which is a fluid part inside the cell. That's what we call cytoplasm, both organelles and cytosol. And then, in order to be alive, it's got to have genetic material, information that can be passed from one generation to another. And this is where that genetic material is contained. It's within the nucleus. Right, so here's the nucleus. Those are the three things a particle has to have in order for it to be alive. cell membrane, cytoplasm, and genetic material. Doesn't have to be within a nucleus, it just has to have genetic material. If it's missing one or more of those things, then it's not alive. It's not a basic building block. And there are many infectious kinds of things, right, that can produce a lot of disease and death in you that kind of resemble a cell, but they're not alive. Okay? And that is, for instance, a virus. A virus has genetic material. It can reproduce itself. It has the blueprint for making itself over and over and over again. It does not have a cell membrane. It just has a protein coat. Think of it like a little crystal. It has genetic material inside a crystal, and it has no cytoplasm. So if it doesn't have cytoplasm, is it alive or not alive? No cytoplasm. Not alive. That's right. So a virus is not a living thing. It's not a living organism. Even though it sort of looks like one, right? Because it can infect your cells, it can reproduce itself, but it's not alive, right? A bacterium is alive because it has a plasma membrane. It has living junk in here, and it's got genetic material. So it is alive. It's a living cell, a really small living cell. So here is a property of life that you can use to fight bacteria. And what is that? What can you use to fight bacteria? You can kill it because it's alive, right? You can kill bacteria. You can stop an infection. All right, now what about a virus? Can you kill a virus to stop an infection? You can't because it's not alive. That's why it's really hard to treat viral infections, relatively easy for bacterial infections, at least with our current understanding of technology. Okay, there are just very few antiviral agents, not too many of them. All right, so this is the building block of life. If you want to build a big organism, what are you made out of? These things right here. But we got to break it down into some smaller pieces. The first organelle that we're going to look at inside the cell is the plasma membrane. That's really a special living structure. And it changes depending on what the job of the cell is, and it changes from one side to the other depending on what side is what's going on over here on this side and what's happening on this side of the cell. So we want to look at some illustrations of what the cell looks like, or the cell membrane. Ah, here's a good picture. So we're going to look at just this little piece right here. And I can look at this, and I see a couple layers. Do I see three layers or four layers? How many layers? One layer? How many layers do you see? I see two that kind of stand out to me. I see one layer that starts here and ends here. And then I see it reversed from here down to over here. So one way that we talk about a cell membrane that surrounds a living cell is that it's a bilayer. It has two layers. And you can see that this unit is repeating over and over and over and over again. This is something called a phospholipid. So it's part fat, right? That's the lipid part. Lipid means fat. And this thing right here is a phosphate moiety. And so this molecule is a phospholipid. So one way to think of the plasma membrane is as the phospholipid bilayer. That's a nice simple way of thinking of a membrane. But if you look at this whole picture, do you see phospholipids or do you see other things?
Yeah.
You see other things too, right? So phospholipid is just actually too simple of a way of thinking of it, but that's the basic nature of all membranes, phospholipid bilayer. But the cell can add things to it. It can change the structure of the membrane. If the structure of the membrane changes, what else changes? The function. That's right. If the cell wants to change the function of that membrane, it's got to change the structure of it somehow. So what are these special structures that change the function? Well, if something wants to enter the cell or the cell wants it to enter, it can't usually go through the membrane right here, but here is a channel that something can go from inside the cell to the outside or outside to the inside, but it needs a special structure. That's what we call a channel. Is it labeled a channel? Someplace. Okay. What else do I see right here? Oh, and this channel sometimes can be open and sometimes closed. And the cell controls when it opens and when it closes. If it's a channel that the cell can open and close, we call it a gated channel, as opposed to just a regular channel that's open all the time. Okay. Here are these little things that look like stop signs. These are sugar molecules. And a simple sugar would be something like glucose. They can be joined together to make a polysaccharide, something with a lot of glucose. And they can be combined in a straight line or with some kind of branching pattern. All right. So these things are little identifiers. These are addresses. And all the cells in your body have these things, these sugar molecules, put together in all the same way. They have exactly the same shape. They have branches in the same place. right? This one has two sugar molecules on it, two glucoses. Another one might have three or four at this branch point, right? But all of these things are the same in your body. We call these antigens, right? And are they on the inside or outside of the cell membrane?
Outside.
They're on the outside, right? So anything outside the cell can identify the cell as belonging to you because these antigens are on the outside. Okay, and so your brothers and sisters have antigens on their cell membranes that look similar to this one, but they're a little bit different, right? So those people's immune systems will be able to identify those different kinds of cells from outside a person's body, whether they're your sisters, your mom, your dad's, or yours, or somebody really distantly related to you, okay? And especially from other organisms, maybe like a bacteria. Bacteria has antigens too. And it's not going to, these shapes right here are not going to resemble a human antigen at all. So our immune system can identify that bacteria pretty easily because these addresses look really different just by the shape of them. Okay, so it has antigens. Sometimes we call these, here's a glycolipid right here. Glycolipid can be put into the membrane to change some properties of the membrane. And here is that term, gly. And then there's O and lipid. What does that O mean? It's combining two things together. It's combining a fat, which is a lipid, and glyc right here means sugar. So here's a molecule that is both fat and sugar together that have been joined together. Right, and here's glycoprotein. It's part sugar and part what other kind of molecule? Protein. Yeah, okay. Here's a cholesterol molecule that's inserted into the membrane. Cholesterol is a fat. It's a lipid, a special kind of fat or lipid, and it can dissolve in the membrane because what's the building block of this membrane again? We call it a phospholipid. So lipids like to join up with each other, right? Oils and fats will mix with each other, but they won't mix with water. It has a different nature. So cholesterol can dissolve in the membrane, and it helps stabilize the membrane, makes it a little bit stronger. Because this phospholipid bilayer is very weak. It's more like a fluid, right? And as you stand up, that fluid would just run right out of your body. So there's cholesterol in here to make these membranes a little bit stronger. And cholesterol, that's the job of cholesterol. Here's another protein. Does it go all the way across? An integral protein, but it has some microtubules attached to it. These microtubules can push and pull on this part of the membrane and give the cell a certain kind of shape, or maybe change the shape of the cell. Some cells in your body are shapeshifters. They crawl around all over the place looking for bacteria, right? And so it needs these proteins right here so that these microtubules can push and pull on them and so that it can move around. What other things do we see on here? That's probably pretty good. What do I have in the notes? Let me see. Oh yeah, here's something important. All right, so we talked about channels. Sometimes there are enzymes in the membrane. An enzyme is something that can speed up a chemical reaction. So there might be a reaction that would take 1,000 years in the cell, and of course by that time you'll no longer be alive, so it won't be very useful for you. But if there's an enzyme, it can make that reaction happen in a split second, okay, very rapidly. So and enzymes can be turned on and off by the cell, and so your cell has control over chemical reactions with enzymes. We talked about antigens, right, supports, but this is really what I wanted to show you, a receptor molecule. Okay, a receptor molecule will be in the membrane, maybe like this one right here. And there could be a signaling molecule like a hormone floating around outside the cell, but it wants to give some information to the inside of the cell, and it can't get into the cell. So it will bind to a receptor that's on the outside, and when it does, right, there's some change in the membrane that carries that information to the inside of the cell. Right, so a receptor is important for communication. So things can communicate with cells if that cell has a receptor for it. If it doesn't have a receptor, then it won't respond to that signaling compound. So receptor is an important thing that cell membranes have. And that's really a big part of medicine these days, interacting with certain kinds of receptors on cells. You find receptors in the cell membrane. The active part is pointing to the outside of the cell. Okay, so you see the phospholipid bilayer, but it's really more complicated than that. So a more advanced way to think about a cell membrane has a different terminology. Sometimes we call it the fluid mosaic model, not just the phospholipid bilayer. fluid because the phospholipid bilayer is very fluid, right? If we put a phospholipid bilayer on a bucket of water and jiggled the bucket of water, it would just ride right on the surface and wiggle around. It wouldn't fracture and bend, anything like that, right? So it's very fluid. And the mosaic part of that concept is that a lot of things can be added to it. A mosaic is made by adding proteins, by adding sugars, by adding lipids, by adding combinations of these things. Phospholipids, glycoproteins, glycolipids can be added to a membrane to change its physiology. And we're not going to have time to study much physiology, though I know you guys are interested. Guess what class you got to take for that? Physiology class. We're going to talk a lot about these things that are embedded in the membrane that give special functions to cells. Yeah.
When you briefly mentioned enzymes and you're explaining to the
I'm glad you asked. Okay. An integral protein, okay, is a protein that's far enough into the membrane to where if you take it out, it destroys the membrane. So here's one that's deep enough into the membrane. And you might be doing some research just on this one protein, and you want to get a whole pail, a whole bucket full of these proteins, and there's not enough room in the bucket for all these other things. So you come up with some kind of method to isolate just this one right here, and when you isolate millions of these proteins, guess what happens to the membrane? It gets destroyed. So you can't study the membrane anymore, but you could study at least this little part of that membrane, right? That's an integral protein. Here's one. Right, it goes all the way across. That's an integral protein because, again, if we take this one out of the membrane, we wreck the membrane. There are some other proteins that are not inserted into the membrane enough to where if you grab a hold of it, you don't destroy the membrane. We call those peripheral proteins, and I see one right here. Okay, so peripheral means that it's associated with the membrane, but not so close to it that you can rip it off without destroying the membrane. Integral means it's so much a part of the membrane that if you take it away, the membrane's destroyed. That's what that means. Okay.
Is it the membrane channel and the carrier molecule the same?
Not really. Carrier molecules. Okay. Sometimes to get material from inside to outside of the cell, you want a channel or a channel you can open and close, and that works just fine. In other circumstances, that channel won't work for some things. It actually has to be carried from one place to another. All right, so, and these proteins will maybe act like a teeter-totter. First, it will be open to the outside of the cell. Something will bind to the inside, and then it's going to go like that. And now it can go to the inside of the cell. Or maybe it has to bind to some other part of the protein that's in the membrane. We call that a carrier protein. If it really has to carry, it just can't move by diffusion. It has to have something that moves it across the membrane. Okay. Physiology. Okay, physiology. Really fun. But first we want to know what? Structure first. Before, I know you guys are interested in function. Maybe after lab or something. Okay. Pump. Okay. A pump is something like this. I'll get to your question in just a second. But a pump, for instance, what would you use a pump for? You're out camping. What would you use a pump for? There's water underground, but you're thirsty. What do you need to get that water? Will it just kind of automatically drift up to the surface for you to drink? No. You got to have a pump. You got to exert some energy to get that water that's low up to the surface. So a pump is a protein in a membrane that requires energy to get something to move across the membrane. So it's an active as opposed to a passive process. Yeah. Peripheral protein, you know, usually they're enzymes. That's probably a really good example. It's an enzyme. It can convert one chemical compound to another. Okay? That would be a really good example. Or it could be a receptor if it's on the outside. Okay? Those would be good examples. And I'm not sure you have a really good feel for what a receptor is yet or an enzyme is yet. The beginning classes are really difficult because we can only describe something with what you have to know in a more advanced class. So it's sometimes hard to say. Okay, so it's probably not appropriate for me to say what an enzyme is, get into a lot of detail, or what a receptor is. But you could see me after class. Okay, so that's the first organelle. The organelle is a building block of a cell. And a cell is a building block of what? Life, right? So I like to use the concept of building block in here. And not only build stuff, but tear it down in your mind. Know what the building block is. Like, what's the building block of a protein? Probably everybody knows. Building is amino acid. Put a bunch of amino acids together, you get a protein, right? That was one of the very early locations of that structural and functional hierarchy of things, right? So, got molecules. Put molecules together, you get organelles. Molecules are the building block of organelles. Organelles are the building block of a cell, and a cell is a building block of life. All right, so we're going to work with that a little bit. Another organelle, which is a building block of a cell, is rough endoplasmic reticulum. It's probably a good idea to sort of know what these things look like. Well, let me go back to that first slide right here. All right, so all of these membranes right here. Oh, what's the basic nature of this membrane right here? Phospholipid bilayer. Phospholipid bilayer. All of these membranes, phospholipid bilayer, but this membrane is different from this one because of the mosaic part of it. Okay, it has a different function. All right, so here I see a bunch of membranes, kind of like lined up in sheets, curls around the nucleus. Here's the nucleus. And what can you tell me about this? These membranes? Do you see anything else? Do they just look blue and smooth? I see some little particles on them. They might have some color value to you, but those are what we call ribosomes. And so it's changing the structure of this membrane. And what these ribosomes do is that they take amino acids and put them together to make a protein. So the function of rough endoplasmic reticulum is to make proteins. So write that down for rough endoplasmic reticulum. It makes proteins, right? And it looks rough because it looks like sandpaper, right? These ribosomes make it look like sandpaper. So later on in your notes, you're going to have an organelle called a ribosome, and you're going to say, what's the function of a ribosome? Make a protein. Yeah, it makes a protein, right? It makes a protein no matter where it is. A little bit special little case when it's on the endoplasmic reticulum. Here's some more endoplasmic reticulum, and you notice it's missing something. What's it missing? Ribosome. So it's not rough. It is smooth. It's important for synthesizing molecules. What it's important for is making lipids or changing the form of a lipid from a lipid to a phospholipid. Do you think it's a good idea to have phospholipids in your body? Yeah, because it has to surround a cell. You got to have those building blocks to make a cell. Without it, can't have a cell. All right, so SmoothER makes lipids, synthesizes lipids or modifies lipids. It's got another function. Maybe I'll tell you right now. It could also store calcium. Calcium is a metal ion, but it can dissolve in water, or it can precipitate out and become something really hard. What can calcium become when it's really hard in your body? Bones. Yeah, it's a building block of bones. And smooth endoplasmic reticulum in some cells can store calcium. All right, so is it important to have calcium in your body? Yeah, why? What happens if you don't? Your bones get what? They get brittle. And probably everybody knows what that's called. That's called osteoporosis. Okay, let me give you a little hint. Okay, of all the places where you need calcium in your body, that's probably the least important place. So you're going to have to come to class for the rest of the semester to find out what these other places are. All right. So, but fortunately, we have smooth endoplasmic reticulum to store calcium for us. Nucleus. Nucleus contains your genetic material. All right. Sometimes we call that DNA. It is DNA in humans. DNA is arranged in really big particles that we call chromosomes. And they're contained inside the nucleus. Here is a membrane. Actually, this nuclear membrane or nuclear envelope has two membrane layers around it. So it's super special. Because since this is the information that's the blueprint for making your body, you don't want to lose that information. It has to be protected. You don't want it destroyed. Right? So the nucleus contains information on how to build your body, the structure of your body. Yeah.
Why is it called nucleus?
Oh. Okay, that's pointing to just this one place inside, just this one little location. The nucleus is this whole thing. The nucleus is this center part. I'll talk about that in just a second. Is it a different color or same color? Different color? Oh, good. Okay. It just looks a little darker to me. Okay. What was I saying? Genetic material. Oh, yeah. So that genetic material is, inside this cell, is the blueprint on how to build the structure of this particular cell. But what does that also mean? What is the nucleus controlling? It's controlling the structure of the cell, but it's also controlling because the function of the cell as well, okay, because it's determining the function. So if this information is destroyed, damaged, lost, the structure can't be built, but what else happens? The function changes. Usually it dies. The cell dies, right? Okay. So this is an important location. Here's another organelle. Kind of looks like a little bean. And again, it has two membranes. There's an outer membrane and an inner membrane. This is a mitochondria. And a mitochondria is fascinating from a whole bunch of different standpoints. We'll talk about one particularly in here. One thing that's important, but not so fascinating, is that it makes an energy molecule that most things inside the cell can utilize. It produces an energy currency molecule that works no matter if you're in Ireland or United States or no matter where you are. It's going to work. Okay? And that molecule is called ATP, adenosine triphosphate. That's the energy molecule. It keeps the cell alive because it provides energy. And that energy then comes from this mitochondria. Mitochondria make ATP. So sometimes we think of that as being the powerhouse of the cell. I hardly refer to it that way. Okay, some people like to think of it. But it's better to think of it as an organelle that makes ATP, and ATP is really important. In order to make ATP, this mitochondria needs something, which is the reason why we inhale all the time. We have to breathe in because we need oxygen inside our body, and we give that oxygen to these mitochondria so that they can make ATP for us, right? And when they make ATP, they produce carbon dioxide, which is the reason why we exhale, right? So it's a good thing, because if we don't exhale, we can't inhale again, right? Okay. All right, so that's really the important thing about this mitochondria. But here is the fascinating thing. It's got this membrane that surrounds it. And it has an inner membrane, too. That inner membrane, you should know, is being the Christi membrane. But it has a membrane all around it. And it has cytoplasm on the inside. And here's a really strange thing. It has genetic material as well. It has a chromosome. What do we call something that has a membrane around it, a chromosome, and cytoplasm? It's a cell. Yeah, it's alive. Okay? So here is what we call the endosymbiont theory of mitochondria. At one point in time, there were cells that had a nucleus and organelles, but not mitochondria. They were infected with a bacteria. These things actually look like a bacteria, have many properties just like a bacteria. Got infected with this particular bacteria. They learned to live together. They formed a symbiosis. And now, since these cells have evolved together for such a long period of time, you can't separate them without killing each of them. Right? And what does a symbiosis mean? Symbiosis means that two organisms get benefit from each other. Right? So the cell is benefited. That's easy to see. Why is the cell benefited by having this mitochondria inside of it? It's giving ATP. The other one is a little bit more difficult to understand. Why is this mitochondria benefited by being inside the cell? Okay? Yeah. Okay, viruses can't get to it. There's an immune system that protects it from the outside world. It gets what delivered right to its doorstep? Oxygen. Yeah, and it gets some other important molecules like glucose. You also need glucose and some other molecules to make ATP. So it's given a bunch of substrates. It's given protection. So it really would never dream of leaving your cells, which is a really nice thing. However, when you have a bacterial infection, what do you take for that bacterial infection? Antibiotics. Every once in a while, there'll be somebody that takes an antibiotic and it will kill that infection, but guess what else it kills? Okay, the mitochondria. That's really rare, okay? And then that person is, they're really screwed, right? So that's really bad when that happens. That might be fatal. It might be progressing to fatality, right? So that's another reason why you shouldn't take antibiotics unless what? You have a bacterial infection. Don't take an antibiotic if you don't need it. Okay, that's just maybe one reason. Okay, I forgot to send the sign-in sheet around, but next week I promise I will. And class is over. Yeah, this class is way too fun. We're never going to get through the class.
It's very interactive. Yeah,
it's fun.